difference between being aware of the breathing and feeling the breathing. No, because when you're feeling it, you're aware of it, and when you're aware of it, you are feeling. No difference at all. So, it's an easy one. Exactly the same. So as long as you know, is the breathing going in or breathing going out? How you know it is really up to you. Dear Ajahn Brahm, you always mention about do nothing, then the mango will fall on your hand. But last night, you demonstrated make effort so that stillness will exist. Now, how do you relate doing nothing to make effort to achieve the stillness? You emphasize all the while. How does one do that? Please clarify. You make effort to do nothing. Doing nothing is not an easy thing to do. You have to be very skillful. You have to try a lot in order to do nothing. Doing nothing is not a skill which comes naturally to many people. You give people nothing to do, and they find something to do. It's really amazing. It's a long weekend, this weekend, and many people in town, they got nothing to do, and they go and find something to do. It's really crazy. We're so afraid of doing nothing. And this is one of the reasons why it's a difficult thing to do. So you may assume that you're putting effort in, but it's the effort to stop. The effort to go against the stream. The effort not to just go on your ordinary ways of doing things, but trying something new. Which is one of the other exercises which I teach people. I'm going to ask you to do tonight and tomorrow morning. I hope you brush your teeth. Just because you don't eat anything in the evening doesn't mean you don't brush your teeth. So when you do brush your teeth, please be aware. Where do you usually start brushing your teeth? Do you someone who starts at the top middle or the bottom left? Where do you start? Because you will notice that most of you are creatures of habit. You always start at the same place every time. Now, try starting somewhere different tonight. I call this living on the wild side. Brush your teeth at a different place. Because as soon as you stop being a creature of habit, you do something different. It's more effort. You know, you can't just, I'm just going to just go on the old habits. It takes effort to stop habits and just try something different. But it also means you wake up. You're much more alive when you don't do the same things all the time. And that's one of the reasons why during this retreat, don't always do the same thing all the time. Sit in the same seat, do the same thing, eat the same food. Try sitting in different places. And I even tell people, no, just don't always sit facing this way. Face the other way. See what happens. Because you find it will wake you up. Because when you have habits, you die. It gets very, very dull. When you do things differently, it gets more alive. So it is making effort to actually to do nothing. It's a very, very, very difficult thing to do nothing. And I challenge you. See if you can do nothing for a whole hour. You find it almost impossible. You're sitting, I'm going to do nothing, doing nothing. And you're not doing nothing. You're actually doing the doing nothing. And that's not right. So you've got to sit here and just be totally inactive and passive. And you start thinking, what am I supposed to be doing? That's not being inactive. You're doing something again. It's such a hard thing to do. So if you can do nothing, then you get very, very peaceful. So we have making effort. Now, one of the ways to achieve this is so many different skillful means. And one of the things you can do here, which is very, 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 very effective, and you can especially do this when you go home, is learning how to be a visitor, not an owner. It's one of the stories in my book, The Good, Bad, Who Knows book. Because many of you know me really well. Usually on the weekends I have to go teaching in Nolamara Temple. This weekend Ajahn Pramadi is doing that so I can be here. So Friday, Saturday and Sunday I work my butt off down at Nolamara. And Sunday evening you come back here and you work your butt off at Bodhinyana Monastery. I'm surprised I've got any butt left after all that working it on. So you work really hard, and it was just work, work, work. And you know, people, you guys and girls, you come to Bodhinyana Monastery, and you tell me how peaceful is Bodhinyana Monastery, how serene and beautiful it is. And I said, you guys must be joking. It's such hard work when you live there. And I realized I was wrong. So I decided one morning a week, and I did this for quite a few years, I still do it every now and again, one morning a week, I would pretend to be a visitor, not the abbot. So people on Monday morning, they'd come up to me and said, Ajahn Brahm, can I ask you a question on meditation? I said, no you can't, I'm only visiting, I'm not the abbot today. And the monk would say, look, I need some help. I said, sorry, I'm only a visitor. And something needed to be done. Sorry, I'm only visiting. I'm not an owner. It's somebody else's job today. And I became a visitor instead of an owner. As soon as I became a visitor, the monastery over the road became peaceful again. It became beautiful. And I realized the difference between being a visitor and an owner. When you be an owner, you've got lots of responsibilities and duties to do. But when you're a visitor, you've got nothing to do at all. So that's why when I was a visitor, I felt I could do absolutely nothing. I could be totally free. And the same with you if you go to visit somebody else's house. You go around for dinner. How many of you go around for dinner and you wash up for them afterwards? How many times you go visit someone's house for a cup of tea and you go and vacuum their carpet for them? It's not your job. It's somebody else's job. You're a visitor. So when you're a visitor, you can enjoy all the facilities without having to do any work at all. So that's why I like spending a few hours every now and again at Bodhinyana Monastery. I'm a visitor, not my responsibility, not my job. I'm just going to enjoy this place without having to do any work whatsoever. It's a way of doing nothing. Now, do you own Jhana Grove? Of course you don't. You're visitors. So you've got nothing to do. Oh, what joy. So you're visitors. Now, do you own your body? Does it belong to you? If it does, you've got lots of stuff to do. If you're only visiting this body, it's not really yours. Great, you can just do absolutely nothing. And just enjoy it, rather than have all these responsibilities and fears. And do you own your own mind? If you own your own mind, you better get into deep meditation and get enlightened quickly. But if you don't own your mind, I'm only visiting, it's not my problem. So who cares? Get in line, don't get in line, none of my business. Hee hee hee. Then you've got absolutely nothing to do whatsoever. So that's the difference between being an owner and being a visitor. And for those of you who've read your suttas by the Buddha kept on saying, this body, this mind, it's not mine. Nothing to do with me, I don't own anything. It's a wonderful realization that no, you don't own anything. Woohoo! So I can't lose anything. I've got nothing to do. I'm only visiting this moment. And I never own anything. Oh, what freedom that is. So that's one way we can do nothing. You know, I don't own anything. It's not my mind, not my sort of body, not my jhana grove, so who cares? Isn't that wonderful to be free? That takes effort. But what I usually call it, make a difference between willpower and wisdom power. The effort which gets you into deep meditation is not willpower, but wisdom power. It's using that effort to be wise and to see things in a different way, such as I'm a visitor, not an owner, which means you know you don't have anything to worry about. So look, if any of you get sick on this retreat, don't worry about it. It's just, you know, sickness is visiting. You're a visitor to your body. You don't own it. So it's not your problem at all. You know, you're sick. You know, as Ajahn Chah kept on saying, if you're sick, there's only two things can happen. You either get better or you die. Whatever way, you don't stay sick for that long. So you've got nothing to worry about. Woohoo! So that is
the effort. Wisdom power, not willpower. To learn how to do nothing. How do the white teddy bears help with meditation? Look,
they are so amazingly peaceful and still. They haven't moved since you came here. They're experts at doing nothing. Can you do that? Look how they haven't even moved. Amazing, just the deepness of their meditation is incredible. And you can praise and say, wonderful teddy bear. They don't move, you stupid bear, what are you doing here? They still don't do anything. And do they complain about not eating in the evening? They don't even eat in the morning either. Look how happy they are. So they're great inspirations for you. And later on also, we haven't got onto this yet, later on during this retreat, you haven't been on one of my retreats before, sometimes, you know, you get a bit fed up. You know, nothing is working. You know, the day of meditation, you're not getting anywhere. You can't eat anything. You can't watch the TV. You can't check your mobile phone. You can't do anything. Oh, this sucks. So what you do teddy bear meditation. So you get one of the teddy bears. I get the nice big one. In your lap like this, nice posture. Hands around like this. And then, breathing in, breathing out. And you just find, because you're cuddling a teddy bear, you know, straight away you get very peaceful, you get very soft. The kindfulness I was talking about yesterday, you know, being aware and being kind, it just makes you feel kind. And I guarantee, if you do teddy bear meditation, whatever other meditation, present moment awareness, or watching your breath, or whatever you're doing, you do a teddy bear meditation, you get into beautiful meditations, which is very pleasant. Which is one of the reasons we keep both the teddy bears here, and you can borrow them at any time. And now once you've got into this, you'll find it'll be very hard to get that teddy bear. You have to be very fast, because someone will put it down and it'll go very quickly, because it's a very nice meditation. And I've got it now, so it's mine. So that's what the teddy bears are, to do teddy bear meditation and teddy bear answering questions. What do you think about this one, teddy bear? What do you reckon, eh? Dear Ajahn, dear Teddy, are devas real? If so, can we hand over our problem to them, or is this just escapism? Oh yeah, there are heavenly beings around, but you know, they're just busy doing their stuff. You can't hand over your problems to them. It's your job, your problems, nothing to do with the devas. So if you go and praying to devas and asking for help here and help there, you're just wasting a lot of time. You usually get into big trouble, you know, when you trust these heavenly beings. I was just editing one of the stories, you know, in, again, good, bad, who knows. I was doing this morning because the people in the United States want it quickly. So there's one of the stories about that guy. And when he was home, you know, just over Easter or sometime like that, sitting in home reading a book, you know, he heard this being, spirit. "Hey," said the spirit. I don't know if you've ever heard sounds like that. Sometimes, you know, you're not schizophrenic or anything. You know, you hear voices and you think, you know, did I imagine that? A lot of time it's just imagination. But he heard it again. "Hey!" And it was a real sound. Something was trying to contact him. And so he listened very carefully, and the sound said, "Go to the casino." And he heard that. Because, you know, some of these heavenly beings, they may be past relations, they're just really looking after you. They want to make sure that you do okay. So, you know, he was a bit, you know, hard up for cash. And there he was getting a deva, a divine being, helping him out with his finances. So he took $100, went to the casino, and as he walked in the door, he heard the sound again. "Go to the roulette table. Go to the roulette table." He heard it very carefully. No, clearly no one else heard it. So he went to the roulette table. He sat down, and as he sat down, he heard the voice again. "Put $100 on number 16. Put $100 on number 16. Now what would you do?
Because you know, this is divine voices, supernatural powers. So he put a whole $100 on number 16. And the croupier, he slung in the ball, twirled the wheel, it went round and round. And where do you think that ball landed on? 16. And he heard the divine voice, says, yes. And he heard the divine voice say again, put all the winnings on number 26. Put all the winnings on number 26. So he didn't even hesitate. He put everything on number 26. Croupier strung in the wall, the ball, twirled it around, went on number 26. And he heard the heavenly being say again, woohoo, yes! And of course, you know, he's already won a lot of money, and all these people were crowding around. You know, he's making a fortune. And then he heard the heavenly being say again, put all the money on number 15. Put it on number 15. And he heard it clearly. And so he put all the winnings, you know, a lot of money, on number 15. And if he was going to win this, he'd be a millionaire. He wouldn't have to work again in his whole life. And imagine that, and just because you hear these divine beings helping you. So he put all the money on number 15, and everybody was just so excited. The croupier, that's a huge bet. The croupier threw in the ball, swirled the wheel, it went round and round and round, and it fell on number 15. Amazing. But just as it was settling, it jumped out and went into number 16 instead. And he heard the deva say very clearly, shit. Oh, shit. Which is one of the reasons, there are heavenly beings, but don't trust them. Sometimes they get it wrong and you lose all your money. So that's my little David story. It's really quite funny. Venerable sir, is rebirth instantaneous after death? If so, this stream of consciousness needs to find a suitable birth in any one of the worlds, irrespective of location. How does this energy travel so fast and still find a suitable birthplace? Does this mean determinism? No, not really. Because it's not so much instantaneous. This is one of the little problems which came in Theravada Buddhism. It shouldn't really be a problem at all. Now, is rebirth instantaneous? As soon as you died, you get reborn somewhere? Or do you hang around for a while? And of course, you know you hang around for a while after you die. There are such things as ghosts, and some of you may have seen ghosts or heard the ghosts. They hang around for a while before they go on to the next life. And sometimes people say, but Theravada says no, there is no that in-between. But there is. The only answer is you get reborn instantaneously into the in-between spot. Okay. So it's just now answering a little conundrum. But, you know, you may have... let's ask now, how many of you have seen or heard ghosts? Have heard ghosts? Yeah, over there, one, two. Only two. So usually more than that. If you haven't heard any ghosts, I'll invite some around tonight to see. What are you afraid of? They're really nice. They're kind. They're cuddly ghosts. They look after you sometimes. Ah, here's a nice little ghost story. Maybe there's a beautiful ghost story. There's this old man in Perth who told me some time ago. He was in an old people's home. And family were not sort of in Australia. I think they lived in England somewhere. And the person in the next room to him in the old people's home was an old woman, and she didn't have any family either around here, so they just got friends with each other. And she would cook something for him every now and again. If she needed any handiwork done, a electric socket fixed or something, he would do that for her. So, you know, they had a good friendship together. And as they, you know, they got to know each other, you know, he did tell her, if anything happens to me, you know, please tell my, I've got a sister in England somewhere. Please let her know. That's the only relation I've got. And of course, you know, he actually died. And he never, or she, his friend, never managed to get the name and address of the sister, you know, who was the only relation over in the UK.
So she was a bit disappointed that she'd failed him. And she looked, through his room, there was no mention or any record of the address. So, that's what happened. So, she helped with arranging the funeral service for her friend. And they did the cremation. And a couple of days after the cremation, in her room, in the old people's house, which was now secure, she woke up in the middle of the night because somebody was stroking her cheek. Straight away, she thought a burglar or somebody had broken into the home. So she was afraid. She turned on the little bedside lamp. No one there at all. The room was empty. The door was locked. The windows bolted shut. No one there at all, but she swore she felt someone stroke her cheek. And then, being one of the old-fashioned ladies, she had a tissue by her bedside, folded up. And she saw the tissue rise up into the air and fall onto the floor. No wind there at all. She picked up the tissue, and on the tissue was a name and telephone number. And of course, you know what that was. She rang straight away, and it was the dead man's sister in England. He'd written a number and told her what to call, because he didn't want her to be too upset. That's what happened. So ghosts can be very nice and very kind sometimes. So don't be afraid of ghosts. They're really nice. And so, we do have that space in between. And, the other story is a really nice story. There was a Thai girl married to a Chinese guy here in Perth some years ago. And, if any of you remember her, she was called Poon Sop. And her husband was called George. And she would always order George around. Always in public. Telling me in front of everybody how bad George was. I really felt sorry for George. But she came up to me one day. She was getting sick. She said, look, I'm going to die soon. There's no really way out of this. And I don't trust George. He won't even do my funeral right. So here's the deal, she said. The Buddhist Society in town, you pay for my funeral. And if you pay and arrange a funeral, I will bequeath half my small apartment in Mayland. It's not a very big, expensive apartment, but half the apartment. I said, look, I'm a monk, I can't do that, but I'll tell my committee. So I told the committee, and they said, the cost of a funeral compared to, half the apartment, it's worthwhile. So we signed a little contract. And it was put in her will. And 3 months later, she died and did the funeral service for her. And the Buddhist Society paid for the funeral service, paid for everything, gave her a nice send-off. And then when it came for, the other part of the bargain, getting half the house, we're Buddhists. We don't go knocking on his door and say, hey, George, cough up, we want our share. we're not like that. So we waited and waited and waited. And then, after a decent time, he said, George, have you got the will? And he said, no, I'm really sorry, I can't find the will. I don't know what she did with it. And we said, okay, never mind. And then, we'd ask him again, found the will? He said, no, I've been looking everywhere, I can't find it. And then one morning, he came to the monastery over the road by himself, and he was really agitated, really early in the morning, just about breakfast time. He said, I want to see you. So why? Here's the will. How you found it? What happened? And he said, last night, I woke up and Poon Sop, a ghost, was saying, George, you know where the will is, get the will. He knew all the time where the will was. But his wife came in the middle of the night as a ghost and scolded him. Get that will. And he couldn't give it to me fast enough, honestly. He was so terrified. Oh, that was so funny. This is so true that that's where we got the will from. Anyway, so there are such a thing as ghosts. Anyway, next question. How do you explain mass deaths from events like
nature disaster wars in terms of karma and laws of causality. In Western world, people easily attribute karma to any negative event that happens to a person. For example, effects and results appear purely on karma. Are there any dominant forces other than karma? Yes, of course. People were asking that question. Was it MH370? Why did all those people die at the same time? The reason is why all those people died at the same time, because they all checked in on the same flight. That's the reason why. It's not karma. They didn't sort of, you know, all do the same bad thing together in a group the lifetime before. So these things happen. You know, we can die at any time. Now, seriously, the great master Ajahn Chah, one of his stories was that one of his disciples, a young man, was drafted into the Thai army. He had a draft, and you know, if your number came up, you had to join. And you know, Thailand wasn't at war with anyone, but they still had skirmishes on the borders. And unfortunately, he was on border patrol, and he got shot at and badly wounded. Now, he survived, but he was quite badly injured. So when he recovered and he went to see his teacher, Ajahn Chah, he asked him, why did this happen to me? Why did I get shot? What karma did I do to receive a bullet? And Ajahn Chah said, that's very easy to explain. The karmic cause of you getting shot was that you joined the army. That's what happens when people join the army. They get shot at and you shoot at other people. So that, and some of you will get shot and wounded. That's the karma. So what is the reason why people get cancer? It's because they get born. When you're born and enter this human life, you can die of so many different causes. If you could only read the contract next time before you're born, it will say in the small print at the end, you can die at any time from any disease, or you can die in sort of a plane crash, you can die in a car crash, you can die in all sorts of different ways. That is part of the contract of being a human being. So when it says, why did these people die altogether? Because they were born. And some of us will die together, some of us will die separately. Some of us will die alone, some of them in company of our friends and relations. That's the nature of our life. But we can't say why it is that some people sort of die of cancer, why some people die of car accidents, why some people die in aircraft disasters. That's not karma. That is just what happens, almost say like chance. Not determined. Who knows? Venerable Sir, is... Oh, I did this one. Rebirth instantaneous. It's already done. Here we go. When I get quiet, sometimes a great sadness overcomes me. What practice do you suggest to explore this melancholic feeling? Tissues. Have a good cry. There was one guy who came here some years ago, Australian, and he asked a question such as this in the interview. So I should mention to you that outside the offices where the monks, you know, do the computer stuff, there is a lectern, you know, one of these wooden stands. And on top of there is the little sheets for interviews. So I put it out already, because starting tomorrow from 9 o'clock till 10:20 and in the afternoon 3 to 4:30, we have interviews, 10 minutes per person. So those of you who want an interview, you can put your name down. And then come up at that time and just have an interview. So at one of those interviews, this guy came along and he said that he was meditating, he started crying. And he stopped it. And I said, what do you do that for? You know, if you feel like you're crying, please, just cry. There's nothing wrong with that. And so he went back and he cried for the next 5 or 6 days. And he said, he was in his mid-30s or early 40s. He said when he was young, he was told by his father, he was a man and men don't cry. And he hadn't cried for about 20, 30 years. And he had all this stuff which had to come out. And he cried and cried, and at the end he felt so happy and so sort of healthy too.
Because sometimes one of the reasons why we get melancholy when you get quiet is because there is a lot of stuff we've suppressed. We haven't allowed ourselves just to feel. So now it comes up, you feel a bit of melancholy or sadness, just enjoy it, let it come. Old stuff coming out, which you should have cried years ago. And he felt so much happier afterwards and so much healthier. And I thought, isn't that terrible? You know, 20, 30 years, because you're an Australian guy, you know, you don't allow yourself to cry. And, you know, if he didn't get that out of him, he probably would have got all sorts of cancers and stuff. So it is all right to cry. So if sadness overcomes you, let it come. Do not suppress it. Don't control it. Just do nothing and see what happens. And then when it comes out, it's just almost like a catharsis, something which needed to get out of you. And afterwards you feel so free and happy and peaceful as well. So when it comes, that's why I say, get some tissues. Let it come and see how much you can cry. What should I do with sleepiness? What are beds for? We've got nice beds for you. So when you're sleepy, go to bed. That's what beds are for. We spent a lot of money buying these beds for you. So please make use of them. But sometimes people go, oh no, I shouldn't sleep. That's being lazy. No, it's being kind to yourself. So if you feel sleepy, the first few days at least, go and take a nap. If you don't do that, you start to feel terrible. Now, I don't know why it is with myself, but you know, I've usually got lots of energy, but there are some times in the year I get really tired and I listen to my body. And a few times, I don't know why I have to do this. If it's at all possible, I go into my cave and lay down and take a nap for an hour and a half. At the weirdest times. And I know every time I do that, I wake up afterwards and I feel great. I feel tremendous. I'm really looking after my body. And there are times my body is telling me, Ajahn Brahm, you need some rest. Ajahn Brahm, you need some rest. And I listen to my body. And when I follow my body really helps me out. One of the reasons I'm fit and healthy, I don't get sick. Because I listen to my body and I know when it says, go and take a rest. And if it's at all possible, I take that rest. And I feel so much better afterwards. And after taking that rest, at any time of the day or night, then I get up and meditate, have great meditation after a good rest. I look after my body, and then my body looks after me. We cooperate with each other. So I never look at my body like a slave. Come on, I want you to meditate now. Meditate or else. Ugh. No, you're kind to it. And that means your body works with you. So what should I do with sleepiness and say go to bed? If I sit on the chair, I get comfortable and I get sleepy very fast. But if I sit on the floor, my feet go to sleep very fast and I started to get restless because I feel pain in my knees. What should I do? Stay on the chair. But you know, if it really gets sleepy, then go to have some rest. This is only the first couple of days of the meditation retreat, so rest a lot. It's amazing just how much rest you really need. And just know, if you don't get anything else, if you can rest during these next 8 days, you will feel so much healthier. And stuff, you know, which causes you sicknesses like cancer and cardiac disease will all vanish. Just the power of resting is immense. And you know why? Our modern lifestyle is so tense, so fast. And what's actually happening psychologically is your brain is realizing, now I have a chance to rest. I can rest. I don't have appointments. I don't have to go to work. I don't have a husband and wife and kids on my back all the time telling me what to do. I've got my own room and I'm allowed to rest at any time. Woohoo! Take advantage of it. Situations like this don't come that often. But then you know, you get your rest and sleepiness all finished with, and then you can meditate and have a wonderful time. You'd be sitting on that chair and you don't feel like sleeping. You close your eyes and your mind is alert because it's done with the sleepiness. So please, you know, just get enough sleep. If you don't sleep well the first night, it's very often that people, when they come to a new place, they never sleep well. I travel around so much, I always experience that. The first night in a new hotel, new monastery, person's house, the first night you never sleep very well. You know, it's just a psychology. Your mind is not really used to the place. But the second night in your room, you know, you start to sleep much better. The third or fourth night is like your own home. And when you leave here, you think, oh, I'm leaving my room. And you get so used to it, it becomes a little home. Those of you who've been here for, you know, many, many times, you know, this place is like a home. And you feel so comfortable here. Which means, you know, you don't really have that first night sleeplessness. You get used to your bed, used to everywhere, and you feel very comfortable. So this is just what happens. So after a while, you sleep very well at night time, and, you know, no stress at all. And best is actually, if you have pain when you're sitting on the ground, sit meditation on a chair more. Do walking meditation as well. If you really want to, you know, you maybe do sit meditation on a chair two or three times, and then after three times on a chair, you can try once on the ground. You know, just to sort of to change it a little bit every now and again and see if after a while you can get used to sitting on the floor, if that's what you want to do. So you don't always have to sit in the same place. What do you think, Teddy? I heard the chanting many times before, but I wonder why every time when they were chanted out during retreats, it sure brings tears to my eyes. There's two reasons why it can bring tears to your eyes. One is it's so bad. I hope it's not that one. The other one, it's nice energy. All these people chanting together. And, you know, sometimes these chants are so old, 2,500 years ago, they chanted like this. And so, you know, it brings back a lot of memories, you know, from a deep past, deep inside of your mind. Times when you chanted this before. Ajahn, noble silence is a gift. Dharma is the gift of Dharma for parents. Some spring, a blessing of nature. Oh, noble silence is a gift. Dharma and parrots chirping is a blessing of nature. Yeah, okay, fair enough. So the parrots can't keep noble silence. So that's their nature. So it's quite nice. The sounds of the birds over here, I like the cockatoos. It's actually quite rare to find so many white Carnaby cockatoos and also red-tailed cockatoos. They're both endangered species. We have loads of them in this forest. So, you know, those big cockatoos you see, and they have either the red tails or the white tails. They're endangered species. So they come here, lots of them, and they know it's very safe for them here. Do you have many of those over in Dharamsala?
Not as many Carnaby, but lots of
rings. Yeah, it's really nice to have them here. So that these are beautiful birds who take refuge, you know, in a place like this. So, and there's the parrots. What else is there here? Well, there's lots of nice sounds of the little birds as well, many of those. Is it the right time we see those beautiful little blue finches? Yeah, they're incredible. They're just almost like fluorescent blue. Really dim, little wrens, are they? But, you know, if you look around, there's lots and lots of wildlife here. And it's all safe wildlife. That's one of the nice things about the Australian forest. There's no tigers, there's no wolves, there's no elephants. Except me, maybe. So they're all really, really safe here. So you can go walking and it's nice. Ajahn, you spoke about putting it down and letting go and how to make it easier by being kind, how to soften the pain through kindness. How does one actually do this in terms of practice? Teddy bear. Say you've got a tummy ache. Take the teddy bear and rub it on your tummy. Ah, that's really nice. It's amazing, just a little bit of kindness actually takes away so many of the aches and pains. Just like when I was a kid and when I used to play soccer in the streets because, you know, we couldn't afford no gardens or anything in London. So I'd go for a tackle playing soccer and I'd fall on the ground and scrape the skin off my knees. I was always having scabs on my knees. Then I grew up with those. But when I hurt, I'd run to my mother and she would kneel down and she would kiss it. Kiss the open wound with her mouth. And straight away the pain would disappear You put a band-aid on quickly and then off playing soccer again the next minute. And it was amazing. I just took that for granted. That's what mothers did. They took pain away. And, you know, when later on when you started doing biology and learned how many germs there are in an open mouth, on a mouth rather, and they put all those germs right on your wound. Never ever got infected. But the amazing thing was, it just, the pain went away. And it's only years later you realize that's the power of kindness. It takes pain away. And if no one else can do that for you, you do it for yourself. So if you've got a sort of a tummy ache or a headache, be kind to it. Now take your hand and just stroke it there. Got a headache? Nah, never mind. Get teddy bear and give it a kiss. Whatever it is. Any act of kindness takes the pain away. And that's just the law of nature. So you can take the teddy bear. If you're feeling really upset, you can take your teddy bear to bed. Tuck it in with yourself. It just goes back to the time when you were a kid, when it's nice and soft, nice memories, nice and cuddly. That's why I have teddy bears here. I have two questions. When I sufficiently calm my mind through anapanasati, that's breath meditation, I frequently experience momentary waves of pleasure. When this occurs, do I maintain the breath as my object, ignoring the waves, or do I switch my object to the waves? Neither. In other words, you don't do anything. Be a passenger. Don't be the driver. If the waves of pleasure are going to take over, they do it anyway. If they're not strong enough, the mind will go back to the breath. The main thing is you don't call the shots. You just sit there and see what happens. But you don't decide what to do. If you do, you'll just mess it all up. Your mind is doing all of this. You are the back seat driver. And I will never forget, and this poor lady, oh, she's still a good disciple. She's been embarrassed for the rest of her life because she picked me up from Heathrow Airport once, taking me to, I just passed Croydon, I forget what it was, the suburb now. And her son was driving, and I was sitting next to the son, you know, monk's rules, and she was in the back. And it was about 1 hour from Heathrow Airport to this place in Kent where she lived, Bromley I think it was. And throughout the whole journey, 1 hour, she was not stopping telling her son what to do. Turn left, turn right, don't be so fast, let that car in, overtake here. In all my life I've never seen such an amazing backseat driver. And I felt so sorry for that son. I mean, it was really extreme. But that is also, why do people do that? The son knew how to get home. You know, he'd grown up in that place. May not go the same way the mother goes, but he knows which way to go. But why do people do that? Same when you're meditating. Don't be backseat driver telling your mind what to do. Come on, watch the breath. Don't watch it this way. Watch it that way. Come on, watch it go in. Don't watch it go out. You should do it this way. Ajahn Brahm said do something else, but I want to do it this way. Okay, I'll try what Ajahn Brahm does now. Do it this way. And please, you can imagine why you don't get peaceful. Shout out, for goodness sake. And just let the meditation happen. So if the waves of pleasure are going to come, they'll come by themselves. You don't need to focus on this or move to that. Just don't do anything. And then see what happens. And next question. I sometimes also see bright objects. Nimittas, should I follow the light? If you follow it, it will disappear. Literally, you'll chase it away. Again, you have to do absolutely nothing. Just sit there and see what happens. That will come to you and stay there, or it will just go away depending on its cause and effects. Nothing to do with you. The only thing you can do is to chase it away. When you've vegged to the state of stillness, what do you do next? Or observe something? Is that veg? That's what I say. You don't veg the state of stillness. Anyway, for those of you who are vegetarians, you only have vegetarian food over here. But if you don't like vegetarian food, you can always walk over to Bodhinyana Monastery. We've got all sorts of food over there. So I shouldn't really say this. Bianca always tells me off for saying this. If you don't like the cuisine over here, you can always go over the road there and see what the monks eat. And anyway, just
I worked out a long time ago, you know, how you can be a vegetarian and still eat beef. It's very simple. It's, you know, before, you know, when you get a cow, first of all, give it a lobotomy. And then once the cow's had a lobotomy, it becomes a vegetable.
Vegetarians hate me for saying that.
Okay, I won't go there any further. So, you've got this state of stillness. What do you do next? Stillness gets very powerful. If you really are still, you have incredible mindfulness. So, you know, you see these incredible nimittas, amazing bright lights, brighter than 1,000 suns, and you're watching those. So, you know, once you really get into stillness, you're on a roller coaster. A roller coaster all the way to Nibbana. So just hang on for the ride. But if you're really dull, that's not stillness yet. You know, just stay there for a bit longer and it all sort of come together. Dear Ajahn, with breathing in peace, is that a recognition of existing peace rather than trying to grasp for peace or aspire to peace or drag peace in? It's just something you can do at the beginning of the meditation to make it a bit more interesting. Yeah, you are doing something. But you know, it's so hard to actually to, you know, change from busy lifestyles to doing nothing all in one go. So it just gives you a bit of something to do when you're learning how to do breath meditation. So, you know, it's not the, you know, the best thing to do, but it works. So if you are breathing in, just imagine what peace is. What does peace mean to you? So when you say breathing in peace, as soon as that word is finished, it leaves an echo. It's pointing you in the direction of what peace is. So listen, feel, know what happens when the word finishes. Breathing in peace. You can actually start feeling peace. So if you do that with every in-breath, after a couple of minutes, you're very clear what peace is. And you can imagine it coming into you. And you do become really peaceful. They're saying what letting go is. What does that word mean, let go? You don't need to find another word to describe it. Just feel what letting go is. And after a while, breathing out, let go. Breathe out, let go. So much stuff inside of you just starts to vanish. Because when you're saying that to yourself, let go, the mind actually does some letting go. And you feel so light and free. So that's why it can be very helpful. Breathing in peace. Breathe out, let go. You do have a lot of peace after a while. And a lot of letting go happens. So it's really worthwhile. Just keep trying and it works. In breathing out, let go, about understanding there is no core, constant owner rather than trying to push things away. Look, you know, don't get too philosophical at this stage of the meditation. Just let go of anything you want to. Yeah, there is no core, there's no self, there's no me, no mind. But if you really understood that, you wouldn't need to be here. You'd already be enlightened and you can have a nice Easter instead of hanging out here with only 2 meals a day. But, because you don't really understand that, you know, you may think you do, but because you don't understand that, that's why we have to practice a bit of letting go until we get close enough to be able to understand that we don't really need to let go anymore. There's no one there to let go. But until that time, breathing in peace, breathe out, let go. Dear Ajahn, can non-Buddhists attain enlightenment? Teddy bears can, can't you? Yes. Well, that was a question asked by the of the Buddha just before he passed away. He gave this brilliant answer. He said, as long as whoever practices the Eightfold Path, doesn't matter what they call themselves, if you practice the Eightfold Path, you get enlightened. It doesn't matter who you are and who you say you are, but it's what you do makes you enlightened. So if you practice the Eightfold Path, then you get enlightened. Doesn't matter whether you're a Christian, Buddhist or whatever. If you don't practice the Eightfold Path, you don't get enlightened, even if you call yourself a Buddhist. So it's what you do, the practice. If I want to take 8 precepts, can I eat cheese or chocolate in the evening? Yes, we do that here. We do that in a monastery. So no worries. In some monasteries you can't do that, so depends on what you like. If you're a cheese and chocolate person, you're in the right group. Otherwise, you go to some other place. Meditation is new to me. I'm easily think of the past, future, and inner speech, but then this morning when I was doing sitting meditation, there was a short moment of stillness, blank. No past, future, thought, no inner speech, and I felt my mind was light, and lighter in silence. Was that the stillness that you mentioned, or I just fell asleep? Although I don't think I was. No, you weren't asleep. You're getting a taste of that stillness. It's only for a few moments. Now, this actually works. Now, so those of you who've been meditating all day, haven't been getting anywhere, or just a flash every now and again, this is only the first day. So just hang in there and it actually starts to work. And whether you like it or not, whether you think you're good or not, you know, whatever you think you're doing or not, it works, and after a while you get very still. And you do have those moments. So it's just, you know, it's nothing to do with you, whether you're good or bad at this meditation, it's just what happens. It's another path. So yeah, that was some stillness there. Obviously you can get much deeper than that, but it's a good start and it feels good. So well done. How do we know if we are already walking inside the path, and how can we maintain to stay inside it without losing focus of it? Many thanks, Ajahn. If you are getting more and more peaceful, more kind, you're losing a lot of your attachments and defilements, things which worry other people don't worry you, and you don't get upset and angry so easily, you're not so afraid of things, then you're walking the path. So you can see it by your emotional reactions to the difficulties of life. You can take things in your stride, you know, people live, they die. You know, sometimes I get what I want, sometimes I don't, this is life. So you can actually tell if you're walking the path just by how peaceful you are and how calm you are and how kind you are. How is the best way to deal with disillusionment, both with the world and one's decades-long practice? How to keep disillusionment from becoming depression? Thank you for who you are and what you do. Yeah, it's disillusionment. Sometimes that if it's real disillusionment, in other words, the illusions are being shattered, you're learning what the truth is. The truth is always very peaceful and happy and beautiful. That's one way you can know it. It's truthful. It's inspiring. It's beautiful. Remember what I said about walking up the hillside when you go really slow? And when you stop, everything becomes so beautiful. So if the practice is going well, it creates a huge amount of happiness. There is one sutta, I always quote it probably many times on this retreat. This is a teaching by the Buddha in the Dhammacetiya Sutta. And a king went to see the Buddha just before the king passed away. And he kissed the Buddha's feet. Because, you know, he looked upon the Buddha like this, like father for him. And he said, and the Buddha said, what are you doing that for? He said, no, because I love you, Buddha, basically. And I also love coming to this monastery. And the Buddha said, why do you like coming to this monastery? And this is the important part of the sutta. The king said, because whenever I come into this monastery, it was the Jetavana monastery, the Jeta Grove monastery, outside of Sarvati. When I come into this monastery, the monks are always happy and smiling. And the Buddha said, yes, that's what you can expect when the monks are meditating, getting insight. They're happy, they're smiling. And I like quoting that because the measure of their wisdom can be seen on the smile on your face. If you're miserable, you haven't really understood very much. But if you're happy, joyful, then that shows that your meditation is proceeding very well. So if you really are being disillusioned from the problems of life, you're breaking through that illusion. It's actually happy and happy and happy. The more you understand, the more peaceful you are, the more happy you are. And that's what the Buddha said. Yes, great king, if people are meditating properly, they're getting insight, they're happy and smiling. Dear Ajahn, letting go helps better meditation. But how meditation can help letting go? That's what meditation is, letting go. So letting go is what meditation does. So basically you let go, and that's meditation. When you're meditating, you're letting go. So you're letting go while you're meditating. You're trying what it's like to let go of things. And you like it so much, you after meditation you come out, why am I so attached to all these things? Why do I burden myself down, say, with the past and the future? You let it go for a little while and you think, how stupid I am to worry about the past in particular. You can't change the past. It's done, it's finished. So why do you keep bringing it up again and again and again? Buddha said you don't learn from the past, you learn from the present. So why do we keep worrying about what happened to us? It just creates more problem for you. And especially if someone hurts you. The old story, someone calls you a pig. And then you start thinking, why did they call me a pig? That's not right that they call me a pig. That's rude to call me a pig. And if you're wise, you realize they've just called you a pig 3 more times. Every time you remember it, they're calling you a pig again. How stupid that is. If you're wise, they'll only call you a pig once. And then you'll let it go. You won't even remember it. Think about it again. Why are you allowing that person to keep hurting you? Someone cheated you at business, or they're very cruel to you 10, 20 years ago. Why are you allowing them to hurt you every time you remember it? When you think about it and contemplate it, it's the most stupid thing, the way we hold the pain of the past. Allowing the past to keep hurting us again and again and again and again. When we know what we're doing, we can let go of the past so easily. That's done, finished with. I'm not going to allow that person to hurt me anymore. It's gone, finished, done. So you can really let it go. So you learn how to let go in meditation temporarily, and it's so nice and so free that you start doing it permanently. And just let go of all the past. This is not a meditation question, but I would like to know if I'm allowed to drink coffee during afternoon or evening. I would like to keep my 8 precepts and strict and as much as possible during my stay here. And who is going to give me 8 precepts, please? You give yourself 8 precepts. Because sometimes people always want to have a monk give you 8 precepts. But you know, I've got more precepts than that. I don't keep 8 precepts. I keep many, many precepts. You can only give what you have. So do you want 227 precepts? So instead of having all these ceremonies of 8 precepts, the 8 precepts are not killing any living being, not swatting mosquitoes in other words, not taking what's not given, all the stuff in the kitchen there is for you, you can take whatever you want, so you know that's not taking what's not given, that's for you. Not having any sex during this retreat. Not, what else is there, not lying, not taking alcohol or non-medicinal drugs. You know, if you want a Panadol because you've got a headache or you've got your diabetic medicines or cardiac medicines, please take them. You know, I don't want anyone dying on my retreat. So, non-medicinal drugs are the ones which are banned. Not eating in the afternoon, and you can have cheese, chocolate, you can have caffeine or coffee rather, or tea, that's allowable. In fact, we call that a medicine. It's called vitamin C. Vitamin coffee. And I prefer vitamin tea. Cup of tea. That's one of the reasons why I became a disciple of Ajahn Chah. Anyone whose name meant tea must have been the right one for an English monk. Ajahn Chah, you know, Chah means tea. Okay, never mind. Did you understand that? Yeah, did you understand that? So you can have coffee. Why can meditation help unlock recall of a past life? What is the mechanism behind this? Remember the 2 types of memory. There's a memory stored in your brain. And that is not very reliable, and it's just hard to access that. It just, you know, the brain has only got so much storage, and the old memories have to disappear to allow new memories to take their place. But there's also memories stored in the mind, and that's what we access through hypnosis. You know, that's why you may have injuries to your brain, but you can still remember, you know, through hypnosis.
And that's also how we remember during meditation. We just access our mind memories. And because a lot of us, we haven't got much of a clue what our mind is anyway, we haven't really accessed it and empowered it, you know, it's very hard to access that mind memory except through this artificial means of hypnosis. I call it artificial, but, you know, it's the compared to meditation. But when you meditate, you empower your mind. You know, the mindfulness gets incredibly strong, brilliant, powerful, happy, joyful. Once you start to get into the joyful, blissful states of meditation, then all you need to do is ask yourself, what's my earliest memory? And straight away, memories of your early life will come up. Earlier, please. And that's the way you can access these past life memories. I will say more about that later on in the retreat when your mind has got more power to it. But it does help. People do that, and it's amazing when it happens. Oh dear, this is a brown pen but not toilet paper. For those of you who don't know that story, if there is some past, you know, which is really bugging you, you haven't been able to let it go, sometimes there's a ceremony which we do, a letting go ceremony of the painful things of your past. And that ceremony starts by writing down what happened to you on a piece of toilet paper in brown ink. So that someone cheated you, or your ex ran off with your best friend or something, and it really sort of, you know, messed you up. Write down the painful moments of your past on toilet paper in brown ink. Because when you write it down on toilet paper in brown ink, psychologically you're making the association with the other brown stuff which goes on toilet paper. It's shit. And also you're making the association, why am I carrying this shitty stuff around with me all the time? Even people who work for the World Wildlife Fund only ever use one side of the toilet paper. You would think that they would recycle it and use both sides. But they never do. So when you've got even a slight bit of brown stuff on the toilet paper, you put it in the toilet and flush it away. No one ever keeps soiled toilet paper. So when you write it down in brown ink on toilet paper, you're making a very strong psychological connection. This is not stuff you should keep with you. And then the next part of the ceremony, you take it into the toilet cubicle. You read it first of all again to reinforce the association. And then you do what you normally do with the other type of toilet paper with brown stuff on it. You put it in the bowl and you do the letting go ceremony. Pressing the button. And all that brown stuff on the toilet paper just goes into the bowl, around the corner, and goes out of your life forever. Sometimes, just saying, oh, let it go, is not enough. You need to do something to reinforce the power of letting go. So flushing it down the toilet is a very good way of letting go of the pain of your past. That's the illusion when they say, oh dear, this is brown pen but not toilet paper. Here we go. Happiness is the proximate cause for samadhi. Yes. When the mind is happy, it easily becomes still. If one's lifestyle, livelihood makes one feel unhappy, tense, this impacts on one's meditation. What is the difference between running away from the difficulties and knowing when one needs to change one's life, i.e. where there's a line? The mind has the power to overcome suffering to a degree, but the Buddha did acknowledge that we are conditioned by our environment. Up to a point, we're more conditioned by our reaction to the environment. And a lot of times you can't change very much, you know, in your livelihood, but you can certainly change the way you react to it and regard it. Look at my livelihood. I live a crazy life. Just this afternoon, it's Good Friday. I call it execution day, as you know. And well, it's being more honest, calling execution day. And
So, you know, I'd go over there. You mentioned there's a fire last night at the bottom of the road, so I didn't get much sleep last night, and just, you know, doing some work here after the talk, and going, and there's this whole mass of people wanted to ask me questions and ask for holy water, you know, sprinkle. And can't I go to sleep now? I'm tired. And I look at my lifestyle. How much of my life is just people take photographs of me these days? I never became a monk to become a model. And even now, I mean, when the retreat finishes, you start get your cameras out and take photographs. And so, I think sometimes I look at my lifestyle, what am I doing this for? I just want a nice, simple life. I became a monk to sit in a cave and meditate all day. You know, that's what I wanted to do. Now look at me. But I know that that's negativity. And so instead of being negative to my lifestyle, I embrace it and enjoy it. So I like sprinkling holy water over everybody. It's good fun. Especially young girls when they've got makeup on. It all drips down. No, I'm a cheeky buck sometimes. But so, having your photograph taken. Yeah, I can do that. Because whatever I have to do, I learn how to enjoy it. My lifestyle is a crazy lifestyle sometimes. But I've learned how to enjoy it. And I had some good fun. Right? When I was with Burr, we went to Indonesia. She was on the same flight with me. And as soon as I got on the flight, it was a Garuda flight. And this flight attendant came up, looked at me and said, "Are you Ajahn Brahm?" She'd read my books, which are very popular in Indonesia. They're all bestsellers over there. I mean, real bestsellers, number one bestsellers in Indonesia. So a lot of people know me over there. And so she stopped and said, "Yeah, I'm Ajahn Brahm." And so I got very good service on that flight. And halfway through the service, you know, Bird saw me. The flight attendant took me round the back to the back of the aircraft, and all the flight attendants were lined up, you know, for photographs. Now, this was, you know, the Perth to Bali flight. So all the people on the flight, they were just all these Australians, you know, going for a holiday. And they were all looking around, what the hell's going on? We want some service, we want another bintang, we want another sort of beer. And the flight says, "Sorry, you have to wait." Photo session. So all lined up, taking a photograph, smile, another photograph, smile. That's my life, and it's a crazy life. But, you know, you might as well enjoy it. So that is my lifestyle. Instead of making me feel unhappy and tense, it could do. I could get so negative about this. Why do I have to do all of this? Why me? But instead of doing that, so no, put some happiness into it. So you can't control your lifestyle, but my goodness, you can control your reaction to it. And that is always a secret. And actually somebody, it was like Danny, she, every now and again she gets these videos out, and they had this person, I think on TED TV, or TED channel, TEDx, and she'd done some research on stress. And to show that just when you live a stressful lifestyle, you don't always get cardiac disease. So she wanted to find out, why do some people with stressful lifestyles get cardiac disease, other people with stressful lifestyle don't get cardiac disease? And the difference was your attitude towards the stress. Those who looked at the stressful lifestyle as a challenge, they enjoyed the hard work. They enjoyed, you know, achieving, you know, building the big apartment block. They enjoyed, you know, having your photograph taken everywhere. You know, when you enjoyed what you were doing, even though it would be stressful, you change your attitude, you didn't get cardiac problems at all. So it wasn't the amount of work you did and the amount of responsibility you have, but everything to do with your attitude towards that. So you can do a huge amount of work, a lot of responsibility, a lot of things, decisions you have to make. If you have the right attitude towards it, you have perfect health. So it's not the stress, but your attitude which creates the problems. Is there any relationship between stillness and equanimity? Are they forms of non-attachment? Yeah. Stillness and equanimity usually go together pretty well. And equanimity usually causes the stillness, and the stillness reinforces the equanimity. Ajahn, I feel neck pain. Yes, meditation's a pain in the neck. That's what it says. I feel neck pain when I do meditation on the floor. Left leg buttocks tend to be numb. I think I experience nimitta, but it's not consistent. Also body pain during nimitta. Okay, if you're doing neck pain, it may be that your neck is leaning this way or leaning that way. So sometimes it's nice to, if you're sitting on a floor, get some sort of stirrup for your neck, your head. So it's always the right place. So get a nice stick and tie the head to the top of it. I don't know, something like that. Or lean back, against the wall, like Lee is doing over there. So that way at least, your neck, can't be too far forward. Because sometimes people get into the habits of, leaning this way and leaning that way, and of course you'll get a neck pain because your head is not properly balanced on your neck. So just check that. And if that doesn't work, you can get, some people here can give you a neck massage or something just to loosen it up. Get under the shower, the hot shower, and just loosen up with some sort of hot water on your neck. Check how you're sleeping at night. Make sure you haven't got too many pillows, not too few pillows, so your head is comfortable. Because all those other causes of neck pain. And if that doesn't work, just the chairs are very, very nice. You can lean back in that and you don't get so neck pain. So check your posture. So you shouldn't really have to endure neck pain when you're sort of meditating. So try and see if you can find a way of overcoming that. Last question. This morning you taught us to breathe in peace, breathe out, let go. Should awareness of breathing be done in stage 3? Would it be too early to do in stage 1? I forget about all the stages of meditation. Just, you can actually do a bit of stage 1, a bit of stage 3, 2, 4 and 5 at the same time. Just like the food you have here, sometimes people being Western food, sometimes Chinese food, sometimes Sri Lankan food, you have a bit of each. Just like a bit of stage 1, a bit of stage 2, a touch of stage 3. That's just nice. In other words, don't keep worrying about these stages of meditation. They'll happen by themselves. So if you want to feel like it's the right thing to do, to breathe in peace, breathe out, let go, a bit of present moment awareness, a bit of silence, that's fine. So don't worry too much about trying to locate yourselves in stages, the beginning of the meditation. Just see what happens. And just be peaceful, be kind, and then it will happen. Okay, thank you for the questions this evening. And there'll be another talk tomorrow morning. If there's something you haven't understood, don't worry. All will be explained tomorrow morning. But for those of you who've got energy, you can carry on meditating here or carry on meditating in your room. Or if you really want to do what I call flat-out meditation on your bed, do some evening chanting. And have a nice night's sleep. If you feel difficulty sleeping tonight, you can always borrow a teddy bear. It's been on my lap for 1 hour, so it's now fully blessed. So you can have teddy bear.